Welcome to the Latchkey Tales, Book 2, Crowley Golden and the Isis Heart, a tale of Egyptian revival, written and performed for podcast by MJ Hahn. Good evening. Welcome to episode 10, and thanks for tuning in. So, listeners, last time we tagged along with Yuki while she followed Wilshire Sutton, at a discreet distance, of course. Then Crowley Golden arrived at the cottage to find that Grandpa Theo's mystery weekend had taken a slightly sinister turn. But of course, we already knew that. Catch up, Crowley. Since then, the Crux Ansata has settled in a new, convenient, downtown-adjacent location. But more on that later. As we fade in, it's time we get Crowley up to speed on a few important details. Chapter 10, The Hideaway. As the sun set on the second day of Theodorus Golden's mysterious disappearance, Crowley sat at his grandfather's workshop table completely freaking out, but doing his best not to show it. The department had long since picked over the cottage for any clues, and naturally, the scene had presented a puzzling question. It seemed that the entire house had been intact. All the doors and windows had been locked as usual. It was only when they had arrived at GT's workshop that the head-scratching had really begun. The detectives had all been collected in a little cluster, chuckling and shaking their heads about the room's slightly sorcerous overtones. It was then that they all turned and gave Morty the same strange little appraising gaze. Crowley knew that they were mentally closing the case then and there, based on his dad's rather colorful history with the department. They scribbled down what few details they could get, snickered, and said that they would be in touch. Since then, Morty had been at the department round the clock, tracking down any leads that he could. Sloane had decided to stay and look after Crowley, which basically meant that Crowley had to sit around acting like he was coping until he convinced Sloane that he was fine. As soon as she had left the cottage, Crowley had made a beeline for GT's workshop, the obvious scene of the crime. Crowley had straightened up the mess of singed papers that had been blown everywhere. He had even swept away the shattered glass that had previously housed the now-missing Dragonflyer. Of course, this particular detail, coupled with the red chalk star in the corner, as well as the faint trace of sulfur that still lingered in the air, didn't sit well with Crowley at all.
What was GT up to all weekend?
Well, clearly some summoning had been going on. Crowley had also noticed traces of a partially wiped-away hex mark underneath the red chalk star, his grandfather's favorite. The Kirkendall doubled attentionary.
Old school all the way. But then he tried to use Trismegistus as well? I don't get it. Someone's been busy.
Crowley's eyes drifted over to the spot on the floor where the empty shattered case had previously sat, and a fresh wave of panic washed over him.
Who would want to mess with the Dragonflyer?
The thought crossed Crowley's mind that GT was simply flying around the city with the Dragonflyer strapped to his back, humming brilliantly along. But then that idea fell out of the sky like Icarus.
Even if GT did get that thing working, he wouldn't have just taken off like that.
Crowley shook his head, while his conclusions became increasingly bleaker, tinged with ever-darkening implications. Nope, Grandpa Theo wasn't flying around someplace. This was bad. Because if GT hadn't wandered off, that meant that someone or something had been in the house. And again, Crowley stumbled over the idea.
So weird. Of all the things in the house to steal.
Crowley returned his attention to the stack of haphazardly scrawled notes that GT had left behind. He raised an eyebrow as he flipped through page after page, realizing that they all seemed to center around the same subject. The Judgment of Osiris. The strange afterlife ritual from Egyptian antiquity, where the soul, or heart, was weighed against the feather of truth by Anubis, Lord of the Dead. If the scales tipped out of the soul's favor and the heart was found to be heavy with evil, the soul was devoured on the spot by a ferocious crocodile-snouted demon called the Ammit. Crowley flipped to the final page. Clearly, this is where GT's notes had stopped. There was only a single unfinished paragraph that GT had titled, The Heart of Isis. Crowley quickly scanned over the few lines.
If the heart of Isis is brought before Anubis, the soul's judgment is automatic regardless of how heavy with evil the bearer's own heart might be. The way to immortality is assured.
That doesn't sound good.
Crowley moved the page aside, and then looked askance at the enormous weathered tome of GTs that had already managed to migrate its way out of the library. Crowley remembered the book distinctly because of its unusual size. He even remembered the book's title, The Light of Mott.
I just moved this honking thing out of here.
He glanced down the book's length, and then snickered at all of GT's brightly colored post-its poking out from the book's worn pages.
Okay, what's so freaking important about the Light of Mott?
Crowley cracked open the enormous volume at the first post-it, and then laughed to himself.
Right, of course it'd be written in Coptic. Great. But hey, look at this.
On the lower portion of the page, there was an intricate diagram, and even though the ink had faded badly, the red five-pointed star still practically burned off of the page. Crowley turned, craning his neck in the direction of the chalk star on the floor, then back to the page while his eyebrows knitted together.
Huh, that's weird. Another red star like Trismegistus's formula. I don't get it.
Crowley turned his head back to the star on the floor while an idea occurred to him.
Well, since it's already drawn out, it couldn't hurt to see if maybe Tina knows anything about this.
In an instant, Crowley had crossed the workshop. He knelt down and reached out a finger to touch one of the red chalk star's points.
Vomacafas matis, avos es, ego, dugo, dastra.
Tina Bleiberman? Hello?
The star flared up instantly, causing Crowley to scuttle back. There was a bright flash, and then the flames were suddenly doused. The red chalk star remained as it had been before, looking like it had just been freshly drawn. Crowley was perplexed.
So what's up with Tina so that she can't be summoned?
It was then that Crowley started when he heard a voice from behind him. He winced a little in anticipation upon realizing that the voice was not that of Tina Bleiberman.
Crowley, what are you doing?
Crowley jolted upright upon seeing his father. But far from being angry, Detective Golden looked much paler than usual. His forehead was creased with heavy worry lines.
Dad? What is it? What's wrong?
Detective Golden let out a long sigh, sounding completely exhausted.
Come on, son. We gotta go. They found your grandfather.
As night fell, and the streetlights switched on block by block, the vast sprawl of clubs, bars, and condo lofts that was known as South of Market seemed to slowly come to life. However, there were still a few dark corners. On a certain discreet side street, much of which was occupied by an enormous old warehouse, the streetlights all remained dark, leaving the imposing structure cast in a murky gloom. Although on this particular night, the upper floor windows glowed with light, and the warm scent of beeswax drifted from underneath the doors of the ground floor workshop. The corrugated iron relic from the 1920s was one of Randolph Sutton's many alternative business locations around the city. And naturally, at the maestro's bidding, Sutton had extended his hospitality to the other members of the Crux Ansada for as long as they required. Anaximander had given his final instructions and had since returned to the Epiron, leaving Mortmain with the rather significant task of incorporating the spoils from their recent trip to Colma into a large batch of candle wax. Of course, Mortmain had complied without a hint of complaint. The floor above the workshop had been converted into a luxurious hideaway where Audra, Desmond, and Danilov had settled in rather nicely. Randolph Sutton certainly hadn't skimped on the opulence. Audra had taken to all of the creature comforts immediately, especially when she saw the enormous, fully stocked wet bar. Danilov had disappeared into one of the many bedrooms, mumbling something about needing his beauty sleep, while Desmond curled up in an armchair, looking forward to some quiet time to catch up on his reading. Some time later, while the air still hung thick with the sweet, cloying scent of beeswax,
a bleary-eyed Danilov emerged wearing one of Randolph Sutton's bathrobes that had to be at least two sizes too big for him. He attempted to tame his wild silver hair into a tangled ponytail as he staggered towards the open kitchen area. Desmond had just arrived at the final paragraph of Paradise Lost, while Danilov began to clumsily rummage around inside the fridge.
The world was all before them. Where to choose their place of rest? And Providence their guide, they, hand in hand with wandering steps and slow, through Eden took their solitary way.
Desmond closed the book and paused at the sight of his little brother emerging from the refrigerator. Danilov turned and stood at the counter while he devoured half a roast chicken with his bare hands. Desmond glowered with distaste, and his gray eyes narrowed slightly.
Through Eden took their solitary way indeed.
Desmond was still feeling a little needled after the complete fiasco the other night in Colma. In fact, as far as Desmond was concerned, his days with the Crux Ansata were numbered. Now he was merely biding his time with this merry band of cutthroats until the perfect opportunity presented itself for him to jump ship, as it were. Desmond had yet to bring this topic up with Audra, mostly because they hadn't had a minute to themselves. But even so, he wasn't exactly sure that Audra would even be willing to follow him. Despite her dislike of the slightly draconian atmosphere, Desmond knew that Audra would put up with quite a bit, as long as the accommodations were 5-star. And the liquor was flowing freely. And then there was Danilov. Well, it looked like the whole situation had been tailor-made for him. Desmond snickered, remembering how even since they were boys, well, make that since the first time he was a boy, things had always seemed to end up unnecessarily chaotic whenever Danilov had his way. It was then that the notion occurred to Desmond that even though his many years at the Curse Castle hadn't exactly been without the occasional misadventure, all of that seemed to completely pale in comparison to the sort of mayhem Danilov dished out with such relish. Desmond's small face scowled as he recalled the recent brutal interrogation of Theodorus Golden, how Danilov had been all too ready to beat the poor little man senseless before Anaximander had even gotten around to asking any questions. At least Audra had been there to step in with her particular hard stare to facilitate matters. And of course, you couldn't get the poor old fool to stop talking after that. For starters, both Desmond and Audra had gaped with surprise when the little old man had first spoken his name. Apparently, the Goldens were interfering from the sidelines as usual. And with Audra's particular persuasive skills, Theodorus had volunteered a considerable knowledge about things that Desmond himself hadn't been aware of. Details from so long ago about his father's death, as well as Lady Iwanaga and her team of shadowy solicitors. Even how Iwanaga had been a friend of his mother's before he was born. Desmond was still a little shaken by that bit of news. Meanwhile, across the room, with an amethyst tiara perched slightly lopsided atop her blonde waves, Audra stood behind the bar, humming to herself while she mixed a fresh batch of her signature acid green cocktails. She loaded a tray with some martini glasses and carried it over to the large sectional sofa, where she had to nudge aside the gleaming brass dragonfly, which was displayed prominently in the center of the coffee table. She poured herself a glass, switched on the colossal flat-screen TV, and sank into the sofa with a little sigh. Danilov approached, looking jovial while he chewed on the remnants of a chicken leg. From the pocket of his bathrobe, he produced a small enameled glass bottle and gave it a little shake with an evil grin. The bottle immediately erupted with a strange, resonant buzzing, and Audra whipped her head around, her golden eyes flashing.
Ugh, there it goes again! That constant racket is driving me mad! Why can't we just recycle that little beast already? It makes me nervous having her around like this. Aw, now, Audra. Just think of her as our little mascot for the time being.
Danilov smirked while he flopped down next to Audra and set the vibrating little bottle on the coffee table. It made a few angry attempts at hopping away, until finally the little bottle settled down. Audra scowled while Danilov continued to chuckle.
I'm telling you now, this is not a good idea. You be sure to laugh it up when she's throwing you around like a rag doll.
Danilov's smile fell.
Ha! I'd like to see that.
He reached over to the center of the coffee table and pulled the dragonflyer into his lap. Audra rolled her eyes and took a large swig of her cocktail.
And again with this brass flytrap.
Danilov looked suddenly reproachful.
The dragonflyer, my dear. Show a bit of respect. This is a bit of homemade artistry. Wish Mort made it have a look at it, though. He'd be able to make heads or tails of the thing.
Audra had nothing more to say on the matter. She fumbled for the TV remote and began flipping through channel after channel, while Danilov's rapt attention was held by the strange, gleaming contraption. Earlier, he had discovered that what had appeared to be the thing's eyes were really its batteries. They had unscrewed and each popped out easily enough, but it looked as though they had long since run dry. Danilov was also fascinated by the four shallow empty slots that ran along the curved back where the wings ought to be, yet there was no trace that anything like a wing had ever been attached there at all. It had completely captivated him, yet managing to find as much as an on switch had proved to be too much for Danilov. Audra poured him a drink and scoffed.
Don't think about it too much, honey. You'll give yourself wrinkles.
Danilov chuckled while he flipped the dragonflyer over and ran his finger along the signature engraving on the thing's belly. Audra curled her lip.
I don't believe it. The Goldens again. Even that little brat Crowley again. Do you know, I took the trouble of making both him and his imbecile father drive off a cliff last year. And still, they do me the discourtesy of walking around like nothing happened.
Desmond let out a tiny sigh from his armchair, and Danilov downed his drink in one gulp.
Well, not to worry. You certainly did a number on that old geezer the other night, didn't ya? He didn't know which end was up after your little vis-a-vis, did he?
Audra warmed to this and sipped her cocktail, looking placid.
Yes. Yet another specialty of mine.
Desmond chuckled under his breath.
Indeed.
On the flat screen in the distance, the evening news had started. Chase Burnham, the mustached reporter for Action 6 City News, looked very earnest as the lead story began.
We're reporting live tonight from Colma, the ordinarily sleepy little hamlet famous for its many residents who have made this fine little town their final resting place. Yet recently, this small community has been marred by an act of unconscionable vandalism. It appears that sometime over the weekend, person or persons unknown broke into the Lady of Mercy Memorial Park, where they proceeded to damage and then desecrate several tombs.
Danilov perked up at once and his eyes flashed to the screen.
Ha! Look at this! We made the news!
Audra looked over her shoulder and met Desmond's look of concern. Making the news never meant good news as far as they were concerned.
Authorities were not notified until this morning, and the Memorial Park has yet to make an official statement to the press. But this just in. We have just learned that an identified elderly man has been found at the scene. The man appears to have been assaulted and is severely disoriented. Authorities are not commenting until family members have been contacted. But we do know that the man is currently listed as in critical condition. We've also learned a ghoulish detail. Apparently, the workers at Lady of Mercy had stumbled upon the man by accident when they were cleaning up the mess. They were shocked to find him hidden inside one of the caskets, and had a difficult time removing him at first because he had been told to stay there.
Danilov beamed, while Audra rolled her eyes.
What? I thought that was a nice touch.
Audra lowered the TV's volume and was about to launch into a lecture about the merits of discretion, when a sudden peal of giggles came ringing up the stairs from Mort Main's work area below. Desmond frowned and took the opportunity to silently excuse himself, promptly vanishing in the direction of the bedrooms. Mort Main emerged shortly after, wearing a brittle smile and his usual black work apron, now splattered with candle wax. Behind him followed the broad figure of Randolph Sutton, with his slick back hair and black pinstripe suit. It was behind him that the source of the giggling presented itself, or rather, herself. Wilshire Sutton had arrived, looking clearly relieved that the luxurious interior of Daddy's little hideaway looked nothing like it did from the outside. Randolph Sutton called Danilov over, and then the three began to confer at the long dining table in low mumbles. Wilshire sighed, looking instantly bored. Then she brightened upon seeing Audra and trotted across the room to join her. At this, Randolph Sutton frowned and barked a sharp reprimand for Wilshire to behave herself, at which, of course, Wilshire scoffed.
Yeah, okay, Daddy, whatever.
Audra looked up in time to see the mass of blonde curls bouncing towards her. Somehow it was difficult to tell if Audra was genuinely pleased to see Wilshire.
Ah, mon petit, très joli.
Hey, girl, what you doing? Oh my god, those shoes are sickening.
Audra rotated one of the toes of her towering stiletto heels, looking tickled while she patted the seat next to her.
Mm-hmm. A girl can always do with a bit more height. Now, come here and sit. Tell me about the little project I gave you.
Wilshire beamed and sat demurely next to Audra.
Oh, that? No problem. We're all set. Silly, silly boys. Oh, and here, do you want these? I'm tired of having to haul them around all the time.
Wilshire unloaded her shoulder bag and began tossing out handfuls of shiny smartphones onto the sofa. She paused when she came to the older model flip phone, the phone that had suddenly rung out of the blue recently with a surprise caller. Wilshire tucked Crowley Golden's phone back into her bag, while her perfectly arched eyebrows locked together.
Maybe I should hang on to this one, just in case.
Audra had been in the process of filling a cocktail glass when she looked over at Wilshire.
What's that, mon petit? Something you said?
Wilshire recovered her smile immediately, and then lit up at the sight of the bright green liquor.
Oh, nothing. Just a little loose end that I had to take care of the other day. No worries. Are those cocktails? Yummy! Is that for me?
As Wilshire reached for the glass, Randolph Sutton suddenly looked over and barked from across the room.
Willie, what did I tell you? No booze.
Wilshire slouched and rolled her eyes.
God, Daddy, you're so lame. You never let me do anything.
As Wilshire retracted her hand, she brushed against the small enameled bottle, knocking it over. It hissed and sputtered at her touch, a strange resonance that made Wilshire flinch back like she had been stung. Audra nodded and patted Wilshire's hand while she assured her.
Not to worry, mon petit. It does that. Just a little loose end that we're in the process of taking care of. Not to worry.
In the distance, the boy's little powwow looked like it was breaking up. It seemed that everything which needed to be attended to was now in place. It was just a matter of waiting for the maestro's big night for them to proceed. They all stood up from the long table, and Randolph Sutton waved over at Wilshire.
Okay, Willie, come on. We're done here.
Wilshire turned her head and scoffed.
Already? But we just got here.
Randolph Sutton's eyes disappeared under his dark brow, and Wilshire instantly relented.
Okay, whatever.
Wilshire sauntered away and began chattering and complaining as soon as she fell in step behind her father, who must have had a particular talent for tuning her out. When the Suttons had finally disappeared down the stairs, Audra let out a loud sigh and reached for the cocktail shaker without looking first, and consequently found herself gripping Tina's bottle instead. There was a sudden violent buzzing, and Audra dropped the little bottle and clutched painfully at her hand, while Danilov and Martinet laughed.
Ah, Merdalo! That little beast just zapped me again!
Meanwhile, across town, up on Green Street, Yuki O'Malley was tossing and turning in her sleep, held firmly in the grips of a persistent dream that refused to let go. In her mind, she was kicking and screaming from inside a terribly cramped space that felt like a tiny cell, but the walls were all smooth and cold like glass. Occasionally, the tiny cell would suddenly erupt with violent shaking, which sent her bouncing off of the walls. It was then that Yuki became possessed with a rage so foreign and vicious that she felt like she could actually burst from it. Suddenly, she found herself screaming and yelling at the top of her voice until her cries echoed off of the walls of the tiny cell with such force that it seemed that she might actually be able to make them shatter. Yuki's eyes flew open while her heart continued to race.
What? Who's there?
Yuki looked around her room, relieved to find that she was in her own bed. Yet the flavor of the dream lingered. Somehow, Yuki had a sinking suspicion she had just experienced firsthand what going all punk rock was like. She sat up in a tangle of sheets and realized that she knew only one person with a talent for such things.
Tina? Oh, Tina?
Of course, there was no answer, and Yuki even felt a little silly as her pulse eventually began to slow. She flopped back down into her covers, rolled over, and returned to sleep. And so, Chapter 10 comes to a close. Special thanks go to guest voices on this episode, Tristy Taylor as Wilshire Sutton, and Leanne Parker as Yuki. Music on the program provided by freesound.org and incomptech.com. I'd also like to thank Random Coil UK for their cover of Satie's Nacien No. 1. For more information, please check out the Latchkey Tales fan page on Facebook. Please stay tuned for Chapter 11. And until then, this is MJ Hahn saying goodbye for now, and thanks for listening.